This week on Decentralize, Wall Street and Bitcoin, the ongoing Ross Ulbricht trial, and then we'll chat with Bitcoin entrepreneur Eric Voorhees.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Welcome to Decentralize. This is James Walpole. I'm here with Eric Martindale and Tony Sakic. It is the 21st of January, and we are recording now with Eric Voorhees, and we're going to be talking about Coinbase's funding round and the Bitcoin's relation to the stock market. So Coinbase actually recently raised $75 million. How do y'all feel about this? What do you think this means for the Bitcoin space?
I'm very excited about this. Less interesting to me about the numbers and the valuations, and you know, you can play the startup game and, you know, talk about, you know, what is the valuation that they raised in this particular round. What I'm very excited about is seeing who invested, right?
Yes.
So the New York Stock Exchange, the actual entity that runs the New York Stock Exchange, also invested in this, right? It is the composition of this round is impressive to me. All eyeballs are now on crypto. It's official. There's no more speculating about this. Like, Wall Street is here. Multi-billion-dollar companies are now playing in this space. This is happening, and that's why I'm excited about it.
The CEO of Citibank.
Yeah.
Or is it Citigroup? One of the two. It doesn't matter. That blew my mind.
I saw that, and I was just like, are you kidding me?
Hey, it's smart from their end.
Yeah,
as
totally.
A business, it's absolutely smart. If I was a bank right now, you know, I would be looking at crypto very heavily. So, you know, it's interesting. $75 million. And it really sets a tone for 2015. And what we were talking about on our prediction or slash, you know, what we're looking forward to episode, it's going to be an interesting year. And I think that we're going to see a couple new companies get into the space. And I also think Bitcoin will finally be challenged by something. I don't necessarily know. I don't think it'll lose. I don't really like to make any guesses on that stuff because I don't know. But I do think that something's going to come out. And I have an idea. I have a little hint of what it could be that might challenge it as far as the decentralized technology du jour goes of the year. My prediction's Ethereum, but we can talk about that later. What I do want to talk about regarding Coinbase and the investors is how are they going to spend this money? Are they going to continue to build the infrastructure like I'm hoping they will? Or are they going to continue to be their own entity that kind of exists outside of the Bitcoin realm almost?
Super Bowl commercial. It's happening.
That's what I heard. I you know what? Like, what rules is that now I am an independent agent? What a bad idea a Super Bowl commercial is. I don't care. Did no one pay attention to, like, the dot-com boom? I know I'm the elder statesman of this podcast, but, man, I saw these pets.com companies blow tons of money on these cutesy Super Bowl ads, and they never had a business model. And you look at it, and you go, like, there were some of those companies that, if they would have existed 5 years later, would have succeeded. IATA is a good example. We had Brian Alvarez as a guest on our podcast. He was a host of that. And if that came 5 years later, they would have actually had money. But they didn't. They blew their money on a Super Bowl commercial.
But Tony, this time's going to be different.
Of course, because it's way to blow your wad. I mean, I guess if they have it to blow, fine. But I would much rather that $2 million spent go toward, you know, just anything. Funding other startups. Funding another blockchain explorer. Funding something that's actually regarding the infrastructure. And, you know, or just being wiser in how you spend your marketing. Do you know how many, like, music festivals that could sponsor? Do you know how many, like, cool things that could do besides that one 30-second ad? And it better be a damn good 30-second ad.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how these investors actually bring sort of their guidance to Coinbase. I mean, obviously, you have a lot of these banking veterans and large institutions coming on board. And I do imagine that we'll see sort of in the actions Coinbase takes some reflection of the will of the investors and also perhaps of the experience of the investors. I mean, a lot of these, like I said, they've been in this industry for a very long time. We'll see if they are Bitcoin true believers, like Brian Armstrong has said. And we'll see what that turns into.
I think they are Bitcoin true believers, so they wouldn't have put the U.S. dollars of fiat money into this, you know?
You know, I'll disagree on that. I don't know that these investors are Bitcoin believers. Hmm. I think they're believers in Coinbase, right?
Okay.
And I think they believe in the potential for what the technology might do. But they're believers in Coinbase's ability to actually bring a product to solve a problem, and whether it's Bitcoin or not. You'll notice that they, you know, Coinbase has chosen just simply Coinbase as their name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they're explicitly married to Bitcoin. They've launched U.S. dollar-based product. Maybe we'll see them register actually as a bank at some point. That seems to be the road that they're going down.
Kind of where I saw it too, weirdly enough. What do you think, James?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Coinbase is definitely different. They are, I think, expanding into things beyond Bitcoin. Whether that's a good thing, I think we'll see. Certainly, anyone who takes advantage of Bitcoin just to make transactions more efficient, to make life and payments a little bit easier for people, they're maybe not Bitcoin true believers, or maybe not doing the most radical things, but they are making life better for people in some small ways. We can certainly applaud that, and I do think they're probably. It's not enough credit for those sort of things, sort of among Bitcoin circles. I'm certainly very excited about Bitcoin decentralizing all the things, but in any small marginal step towards that, I'm very excited, very happy about that.
Absolutely. And I want to do what I usually do and derail this off the show notes because I didn't have a chance to add this. But, it's what's today's date? It's January 21st, and there's been no Cicada 3301 clue. I don't know if that means anything to anyone at this table, but it means a lot to me because no one has found it, if it's out there, which it might be. Rumor has it from last year's puzzle that they were not going to be using 4chan to recruit this year. And I don't know who in our audience would care, but I have a feeling there's a lot that do. I tried, in my amateur cryptography skills, that's what actually got me into a little bit of this stuff, was trying to figure out this Cicada stuff. And, I just want to encourage everyone that's, listening to this to Google Cicada 3301 and Google some of the ethos behind it. And you'll see something really interesting that's happening in the deeper layers of the internet. And I don't mean like Tor. I mean like on layers of forums, things that you wouldn't find. What were you going to say?
Is it cicada? Cicada?
Yeah.
Because it's the insect, right? 3301.
Every 17 years, it respawns. And that's the gimmick, right? So there's a very good idea that's happening where it actually is a bunch of the cypherpunks from Berkeley. Because one of their original remailers was named Cicada. So there's a lot pointing to that, which is very much the roots of Bitcoin. I have a feeling these people that are involved, the Hal Finneys of the world, the Nick Szabos, I have a feeling that they're all more involved with a lot of these things than most people are thinking. I guess a lot of people do think they are involved. Either way, Cicada 3301 was something that fascinated me, and it took over one of my entire Christmas breaks. I just got sucked in. And, that since there's no clue this year, it makes me wonder, there is a clue, it's just we haven't found it, or it hasn't been publicly found.
Or the fact that the absence of the clue is a clue. So this has been going on for what, 3-4 years now?
Yes.
And every year on January 5th, exactly January 5th, one of the clues is released. This year, obviously, they're breaking rhythm. Maybe they're going to release another one. Maybe nobody's found it. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're not releasing it, and it becomes a pattern as to which years they release a clue on is part of the clue, right?
Yes.
Who knows? And I think that's one of the most exciting things is the sort of mystery is nobody knows. This is almost like the monument in front of the NSA or CIA, right? This giant puzzle that for 50, 60 years now, nobody has solved, right? It just gets at you, right? Because everybody has this like built-in natural curiosity. And like, what is it? And
like
everybody,
Satoshi.
Exactly.
Which it wouldn't surprise me if they were one and the same. but the other thing I would say is there's a quote that comes along with the Cicada puzzles. And it's my quote of the year. And it's find the divinity within and emerge. And it does refer directly to the insect from emerging from the instar phase of the cicada. I might be mispronouncing it. Either way, I think that's a great quote. And, regardless of how you feel about this, I want to encourage everyone that listens, including like my mom that listens, learn about this stuff. You do not need to be a computer scientist. You do not need to be a mathematician. You do not need to be a cryptographer. You do not need formal training to grasp what's happening. And there's things that are happening that are really interesting in tech right now, and that's why this podcast exists. Do a little research. Teach yourself. Find the divinity within and emerge, which just means find the part in you that has that curiosity that's seeking some truth. And you never know what truth could be to you, but man, for me, it led me to this cool, this cool podcast, this cool culture, this cool thing that's happening, that's changing things very subtly in the background. And I wanted to name drop that because I actually this week accepted an offer from Augur, and I am now employed by Augur. So in the next week or two, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. But it was one of those quotes that, really got to me when I first heard it. And the more I think about it, the more I think, you know, my interest in this kind of stuff wasn't taught in school. It was just taught from general curiosity, which is where all like positive, awesome things come from, your heart, you know, your soul. So I'm going to, you know, hold off on a lot of the Augur talk other than plugging the website augur.net and saying it's a decentralized prediction market. And it's affiliated loosely with Ethereum, very loosely. Vitalik is an advisor, and I'm actually looking very much forward to meeting him. I got to meet him for like a second, but I haven't actually had to have a conversation with him. So I'm that weird marketing guy that everyone's going to be giving weird looks at. But so far, you know, I'm trying to make myself also the crypto-friendly marketing guy. So with that being said, that's my long cicada Augur spiel. We can continue on with our topics at hand.
We're very excited for you, Tony, and congratulations on finding your divinity.
I did, from within, which also is a reference to the golden ratio. Thank you very much.
Yes, and I'll be glad to make the decentralized prediction that you're going to be doing very well there. So we're very excited about that. But kind of speaking about mysteries, like sort of like cicada and these cryptography, sort of these puzzles, let's sort of talk about another mystery. It's sort of been unraveling this week. The trial of Ross Ulbricht is actually been ongoing in New York, and Andy Greenberg from Wired, as well as a few other journalists, have been covering sort of the revelations that have been forthcoming from this. One of these, on the first day of the trial, Ross Ulbricht actually admitted to being the founder of the Silk Road. What do you guys think about that?
Dude, this whole thing is just so... Like, you can't write a more exciting book than this, right?
The Bible. I'm just kidding. Hey, it's a good book. I'm sorry if I offended anyone. I just had to name drop the most popular book of all time and compare it to this trial.
So, I mean, okay. So not only... I don't know that he necessarily claimed to be the founder.
Not DPR, but he did the defense. They claimed that Ross actually started the Silk Road website, but passed it off to DPR.
Okay. I thought it was magical tux. I thought it was magical tux.
So we're getting to that.
All right, right. So he claimed to be the sort of initial idea. Is that okay? So one of the things that got really exciting to me, and I just had to like sit back and everybody was talking about, you know, get an industrial grade, industrial order of magnitude of fucking popcorn because this is going to be a good show. The thing that was really, really exciting to me was this other scandal, the Silk Road thing, or the Mt. Gox, right?
Yes.
It's funny because I've totally tried to like purge that from my mind. Like that has completely fallen off my radar.
You don't trade magic cards anymore, Eric?
No, it's just Ross ultimately like points. I guess they insinuated that actually Mark Karpels himself was with DPR at some point. And I think actually even in where the Dread Pirate Roberts comes from, the Princess Bride, right? Like the title of DPR is like passed Dread Pirate Roberts, mm-hmm. like it's passed on from mm-hmm. person to person over time. If Ross Ulbricht is the original founder, but the person who was claiming the title of DPR at the time was not actually Ross Ulbricht, right? Like there's no real case here, right?
And it was so interesting too. The way the defense explained this when they sort of talked about Ross actually founding the site, they said that he founded it as an economic and philosophical experiment, and basically in free trade of these goods. Seeing sort of that twist in actually sort of bringing some of the political philosophy into the arena on that. When we spoke last week, we sort of mentioned that this has been something that's been very discouraged, obviously by the prosecution, but. They were certainly able to work it in there, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how the jury responds to that.
Yeah, at the outset of the trial, I think the judge even said, you're not allowed to bring your political views into the trial, right?
Just the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Well, I mean, it's right.
It's totally like, don't be you, just be a robot.
Right. Well, right. I mean, because there was an ongoing discussion about jury nullification, and if, you know, the jury concludes that, you know, the charges that are being brought up, the laws that they're based on are simply, you know, immoral and wrong, that they're going to, you know, nullify the law, then it throws the case out the window, right? And, mm-hmm. and, you know, the government at this point needs this to be a conviction because, you know, they must set an example of, you know, innovators and entrepreneurs who are going to try these philosophical experiments. We will not tolerate this, right? Like, come on, like... This is a really pivotal case for law and as it applies to decentralization.
I agree in principle, but I also think that Ross Dewey was playing with fire. And when you play with fire and you get burned, you know, I mean, I feel bad for him because I do, you know, the part of me that does love the free market entrepreneurial sense is a fan, but the other part of me is really hoping. I can't wait for the post Silk Road era of this type of technology where we can stop talking about Bitcoin drugs, because really,
well, Silk Road wasn't all drugs, mind
right? But what does the common person see in the media?
Sure.
You know, and I can't wait till Vic gets past that, you know, instead. And it's cool that right now we're hearing this Coinbase story where we're hearing, you know, what the outside world of outside of the Bitcoin bubble thinks of this, you know, that there's entrepreneurs and business people that are respected by some that are getting involved. I think that's more encouraging. I think the new companies that are coming out are more encouraging. It actually kind of depresses me that it's covered so much, the whole Silk Road thing. I mean, it's important, but it's also something where there's much cooler things happening right now that are, if you look around and if you focus on those, like it's becoming like a second era of freedom, and you're seeing it happen. You're seeing the seeds planted right now. And, you know, look at that. That's so awesome that you get to be a part of, you know, this part of human history where this is happening. And a lot of this is just going back to, you know, U.S. Marshal seizures, auctions, drugs, you know. And I guess it is what it is. You can't stop the curiosity about it. But it's still, I can't wait till this era is done. I can't wait till the Gox era is done. I can't wait until the all of this is over and we're into, you know, credible companies existing.
What I'm really hopeful here is that this raises the dialogue, and that the judge, I hate to admit it, but I'm fairly confident that Ross is going to be
Kangaroo Court.
Yeah, totally, mm-hmm. Totally agree. He's going to be convicted of a number of these charges. However, what I'm very hopeful for is that this trial of this case, as I'm not confident that it's going to be the last one. This particular trial, I hope that it will raise the dialogue as to, you know, what does it mean to actually have decentralized law? What does it mean to build a free market? Like, it was Ross actually playing with fire, as you said, right? He's trying a philosophical experiment. Even if he was the founder, he just built a marketplace. Is in convicting Ross, will the court be saying that, you know, building an idea, you know, trying to test an idea of a free and open marketplace, you know, is something the government does not want, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what I'm really worried about, is if that dialogue doesn't come up, right, if he gets convicted, it needs to get appealed and brought to a higher court. And I think that ultimately should be the resolution here, is bringing this to a higher court, so that the dialogue gets more and more visibility and attention, because that's what it needs, is people need to start asking these questions, right? People need to start questioning, you know, these laws that have been sent down to them.
And I think that you're going to see a generational gap, and that's what the issue, if it goes to a higher court, is going to come down to. Yeah. There's going to be a generational issue. It just seems inevitable.
But, you know, I think what you're saying, Tony, that we're actually really far from seeing the end of decentralized marketplaces.
Yeah.
And I think this is actually extremely important for that. Like Eric was saying, this is about being prosecuted for what happens on your decentralized marketplace. Obviously, you know,
He did profit from it.
We certainly profited from it, but the idea, at least according to the defense, is that he founded this program but really passed it on to someone else. But he is being prosecuted for it. So I do think it's very important. I think if we are going to see the second flourishing of freedom, like you're saying, the precedent is set by this case is going to be one of the big determinants for that. So I'm not wanting to move past this necessarily. I don't want to forget about this and move on, because I don't think we can.
I think that's what will happen. I think that it's the same thing that happened with the numerous P2P services that existed, the Kazaas, the, you know, LimeWire still around. I mean, what I was saying about it being a generational gap is there are people that just will not understand this. Like, flat out, do you think the Supreme Court, that doesn't even know how Netflix works, really can understand and wrap their heads around something like a decentralized marketplace? Seriously, like, the people that are responsible for legislation have no idea. And if they have no idea, how can you expect, you know, progress to be made? Which it will. It just is going to take time. This is not something that's going to be happening soon. This is going to be happening over decades after, you know, the existing power structures exit, new people in power come into power, and hopefully, you know, they introduce technologies like this to give power back to the people, which is really why, you know, I think a lot of people are so excited about it.
So let's talk about a few positive things that have actually come out this week. Sort of besides what's going on with Coinbase, we're also seeing other projects in sort of decentralized and peer-to-peer technologies. One of these I'm really excited about is a new app called Be My Eyes. And this is all about actually connecting people who have challenged vision, basically, sort of the blind and the visually impaired, with people who can actually see and actually communicate to people via a video app what people are seeing in front of them. So you can definitely see a lot of applications for this in making life easier for the visually impaired. And I'm very excited about this because I do think this is actually, and Eric noted this earlier on, this is actually bringing something of a sharing economy to health and to sort of these basic parts of life. What do you guys think about this?
Dude, this practically moved me to tears. This is such a powerful use case, I think, for distributing actually, you know, the assistance that, you know, people who are perfectly, you know, able and, you know, other than the simple fact that they can't see, rather than having a dedicated person or, you know, being or an animal, you know, assist them through the day-to-day basis, like when they need it, they can bring someone online, and anybody can sign up to be that person, right? It's not hard. You just wire up to the camera. So this is just such a clear use case that I'm really excited about, and I hope it gets the wheels turning in a lot of other aspects, whether it be in healthcare or, you know, other entrepreneurial endeavors. I'm super excited about this because it is such a clear use case.
And it's a neat idea. I don't necessarily think, I think it's a band-aid solution to, you know, technology that's going to come from optics that will actually solve blindness and vision impairment. But I will say one thing, and this, they need to change the picture on their website because it is creepy. And it's such a cool idea. And as soon as I go to the website and I look at this picture, I get what it's meant to say, but just use different eyes. That's me being putting my marketing hat on, but that picture really freaks me out. I'm sorry, I can't. Like, it is.
I love it. Like that's, it's so impactful that you just
you might be right.
You will remember
yeah.
that.
You're right.
You
you're
will
right.
absolutely remember that. And I think it communicates what they do very well. For those of you who aren't aware of Be My Eyes, basically. It's an app for the phone. If you're blind, you can press a button and request help. It'll use your phone's camera to wire you up with, I guess, a round robin selection of, you know, the next available person who can describe to you and help you through what's going on in front of you. And this image is what looks like a female's eyes on a bearded man in the background behind them. He's holding up his iPhone to his face.
It's like a seductive look.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's capturing. I remember seeing this, and it strikes you. It really sticks with you, and I like that. I think that's a powerful message.
Yeah, and what I think is so cool about this is that these are the kind of charities that I love to support the most, because you're actually doing something and you're not just giving money to someone where you never know where the accounting is going. That's why I'm a big fan of, I think it's GiveWell, but very big fan of this. BeMyEyes.org. Volunteer 10 minutes, you know, help someone who's visually impaired, you know, buy groceries, help someone, you know, who has those issues. Because, you know, in one of my previous positions, I remember there was a few visually impaired folks that would come through. And, you know, the struggles they face are really harder than most imagine. And usually they're the last ones to gripe about it, because I'd be complaining like you wouldn't believe, and they don't. So help out. You know, in fact, I'm planning on doing that myself with this site, and I want to try it out and see how I can help, even if it's 10 minutes a day.
It is amazing. And I will say that it's impossible to be cynical about a project like this. I mean, oftentimes in Bitcoin.
I was with the photo.
I'm sure the service dogs are too. I mean, service dog Luddites will be forming unions soon and smashing these apps. But for me, it's really impossible to be cynical about it. And oftentimes, you know, in the Bitcoin space or in decentralization, there's so many scams out there and so many things that really bring you down and make you forget about how you got into technology in the first place. And it's these sort of things that really make life better for people. That do extraordinary things to bring people together, to change the way we interact with people, and to change the way maybe we view people with, you know, handicaps or other impairments. This is what brought me into tech and what makes me really excited about this movement.
And there is one final thing I want to talk about real quick, and that was Obama's State of the Union speech and his comments on basically internet security and, you know, the hubbub around the Sony hacks. And this is just a call to action. Follow the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Make sure that you're not giving away your rights for a corporation's security. Just because they don't know how to secure their data doesn't mean you should be giving up your rights. And it's very important, because they're going to use that in the same way the Patriot Act was used to inhibit your rights. So I just want to say that, you know, research this. That's the one thing from the State of the Union that really caught me, and I knew he was going to comment on it. it's not about the interview movie leaking or not leaking, but, you know, hacks and things like that. This is about your data, what you have the right to, and your privacy. It's important, really important. And cryptography is not a crime. It's not a crime to, you know, have a private conversation with someone via digital means. And remember that, and remember to stand up for that. It's really important.
And on that note, we're going to bring on Eric Voorhees and sort of talk about Bitcoin and where that's going.
All right. We are here today with Eric Voorhees, an early Bitcoin adopter and current present media mogul, I would say. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you were an early adopter. You know, talk to us a little bit. You know, everybody's sort of got their own story about how they discovered Bitcoin. Talk to us how you discovered Bitcoin and what really got you excited about it at, in the very beginning.
Yeah, I will take you back to the long, long ago in, May of 2011, early May. I learned about it from a Facebook post. A friend of mine up in New Hampshire, part of the Free State Project, posted some little article about this weird, you know, digital money that had soared in value by 50,000% since the prior October. And so you see a headline like that, and you have to just think, well, what the hell is that? And I clicked on it, you know, thinking that this looked pretty, and what the hell is this stupid Bitcoin thing? And was obviously very skeptical at first. And then as soon as I understood the most crucial point about it, which was that it had no counterparty, no central controller at all, and how that freed it from all sorts of problems that other forms of money and payments had faced. Then I got hooked real quickly and probably lost quite a bit of sleep over the next few days and just kind of dove in and went down the rabbit hole, and I'm still stuck down here.
It's funny, you're using the same words that we often use. It's that rabbit hole. I think a lot of us had the same experience of, you know, spending, you know, once we learned about it and got this like core idea, we spent like a week just completely reading everything we had or could get our hands on. And one of the questions we like to sort of ask, sort of bouncing off of that, is, you know, everybody's got their own explanation as to what Bitcoin is. And I think you sort of touched on something that's really important there, you know, the lack of a counterparty. Can you explain, you know, in your words, what exactly is Bitcoin?
Yes, and this is certainly the most important question for all the people who still have not gotten involved. And I think the most important point to start with is that it is two things primarily, and they both share the same name of Bitcoin. And the one thing is it is a payment network, much like PayPal or the Swift banking network or something like that. And the second thing it is a currency, you know, like dollars and euros and yen. And so it is both those things, both that share the same name of Bitcoin. So that's what it is. And then the more important question of why it matters is it matters because, unlike those examples I gave before of PayPal and banks and all that, it doesn't have any central organization that controls or manages it. So that allows someone to transfer value anywhere instantly without anyone controlling it whatsoever. And this has all sorts of profound implications that are interesting to get into, but that's the basic overview.
Okay, great. That's fantastic. Yeah, look, can we talk just a little bit about, you know, what are the implications? You know, I think a lot of our listeners are, you know, familiar with Bitcoin and the blockchain in general. If we talk about Bitcoin, there's, you know, the currency aspect. But since Bitcoin has launched, you know, the blockchain has gone on to disrupt a lot of other industries as well. What are some of the biggest implications that you're seeing sort of coming up and coming down the pipeline?
Well, so there's sort of concentric circles of implications here. And sort of the basic one is that Bitcoin disrupts all sorts of different businesses that are in the business of moving money. Because up until Bitcoin, the work of moving money around was something that businesses had to do. It required lots of work and control and management and, you know, paperwork and everything to move money from one place to another, even though, you know, most money is digital today anyway. So now that Bitcoin is here, we can move money without any of those companies. So that has huge implications, you know, for those companies specifically. Companies like, you know, Western Union are the obvious ones. And then, you know, beyond that, it has implications for the wider banking and finance industry, because a lot of the ways that banks work are incompatible with Bitcoin. And so to the extent that Bitcoin becomes widely adopted, banks are going to have to adapt or be phased out or something. They're going to have to change in a quite a profound way. And then the most interesting ramification of Bitcoin is that it is a money that cannot be printed, cannot be created out of thin air, unlike any fiat currency that is used by the various peoples of the world. And so again, if it becomes widely used, then it severely limits the ability of governments to print money and pay for all the things that they pay for. So it sort of shackles the ability of governments to do what governments like to do. And that is pretty wild to consider as well.
I love it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I as I was doing some research into you and your history, there's a certain part that really caught my eye. And it's something that I really want to discuss further with you. And I hope, you know, we can take 10 minutes here and talk about this, because I've wanted to talk about this in the show for a minute. It just hasn't come up, but you're the perfect guest for this. One of your previous positions, from what I understand, and if I'm wrong on this, then the next 10 minutes are going to be moot. But you were the director of marketing at BitInstant, correct?
Correct. Yeah, correct. I was employee number 3, I guess.
Nice. So here, when it comes to marketing, marketing is traditionally a dirty word. I agree with that, and I'm in marketing. You know, there's this idea that you have to be kind of sleazy and you have to try to sell something, that you have this used car salesman vibe, and I disagree completely. It's about one thing. It's about the product, right? If you have a shitty product, you're going to need to be a sleazy car salesman. If you have a killer product, you really don't have to try too hard. I mean, you have to try and you have to know your product, but that's all you have to do. So I think in general, since this is something that I've noticed and I've identified plenty of the issues about a year ago, overall with Bitcoin, and Bitcoin needs a marketing plan. Now, obviously, you know, Bitcoin is not a company, you know, it's a protocol, you know, it's like saying email needs a marketing plan or something of that nature. But the nature of it itself leads to confusion. It leads to no brand identity. It leads to a lot of other issues. And before my time was up at my previous employer, I had an idea. And one of these ideas, and I'm gonna share this with everyone, because I'm a firm believer that if a good idea it happens, I don't need to capitalize on it. I just hope that they recognize that I'm someone who thought of this, because maybe someone else has. Bitcoin needs to be universally identifiable. And what I mean by that is, what is the marketing plan or the marketing image in your mind when you think of the U.S. dollar? There is one. You don't think about it, but there is one. It's greenbacks. It's a dead president. It's a dollar. It's Illuminati symbols, which I love to bring up just to giggle. You know, there's a lot of things when you think of the dollar. And when you think of the Bitcoin, when you think of the Bitcoin, I hate to say it like that, but when you think of Bitcoin, what do you think of? You know, I personally think of an orange symbol, and I think of the technology behind it, but that's because I've studied. But what does person X think? What does someone on the street think? I'm talking about someone, you know, there's an old adage we had, we used, what would your drunk great-grandma think? And I think that's a great way to view anything, is what is the perception, right? The perception right now of Bitcoin at this given time is that it's an investment that is devalued a lot over the past year, and that it's a terrible investment, and that led to it being unsuccessful. And I want to wave my hands and say, you're so wrong. Like, there couldn't be a more wrong perspective to have. But for one thing, someone's opinion is never wrong, but it is wrong factually on how they're backing it. And what they're backing it with is the value, and not the value of users, not the value of how it's changing things, and many other items. This is something I proposed, which is something like a DVD forum. I don't know if you're familiar with the DVD forum, but it's something where all the manufacturers of media came together and they decided on a set of ISO specifications that basically standardized the DVD format, how it was marketed, that DVD logo you see, the CD logo you see. I think that's something Bitcoin needs. It needs it drastically now more than ever. It needs all the companies in the space to get forward, especially the big dogs. And you know, really have an identity, a mental identity for someone. Like when they see McDonald's, they know the Golden Arches. When they see Bitcoin, they know this. And I really think that that's something that's important. And what is your perspective on that? What is the overall vision of Bitcoin, and where do you think that could go? How do you think it should get there? And, you know, I personally, as an aside, I don't think that a coalition like the Bitcoin Foundation is perfect. I think it has to be a loose coalition of Bitcoin-related companies. But what do you think on this in general? What do you think Bitcoin needs to be sold to the general public?
So, interesting question.
Thank you. I try.
I don't think... Bitcoin is not a product. It is a technology.
Right.
And it has all sorts of interesting uses, some of which we know, some of which are still to come. But they are very diverse, just as the internet had lots of diverse uses. So in the same way that, you know, if we had gone back to 1994 and had the same discussion and said, well, you know, this internet thing is super cool and we have huge potential, let's get all the internet companies together and start marketing the internet. And, you know, maybe that would have been successful, but what would be the message? I mean, you'd have to agree on one message, target a certain demographic, have a certain brand and all that. And you would miss the diversity that the internet became, because the internet is it's a platform. It's not one product. It's a whole platform of various things. Bitcoin is very much the same way. So I think that a marketing plan for Bitcoin proper would at best have limited value, and at worst would just cause a bunch of differing interests to bicker about it. So I think what's more important from a marketing perspective is for the specific use cases and the companies involved in those to market to their own consumers. So let's take some of the new remittance companies that are starting up. They are using Bitcoin, and they have a very specific demographic, and they know the messaging to reach those people. So they don't need to advertise Bitcoin. They just need to advertise their service, you know, sending money to your family at near zero cost. And they can market that angle. And then a company like BitPay can market its angle, which is allowing merchants to accept payments more easily online. So each of these companies with their own specific products can market them to their users. And as that process happens, Bitcoin usage will naturally grow.
Yeah, and I think that this is where, you know, this is where a company like Coinbase comes in. And I think, if anything, they're the AOL of the Bitcoin companies. And that's not a bad thing. You know, AOL got a lot of people that had no idea or real interest into the internet involved, right? AOL is the first ISP I ever used, you know, and it was the first ISP I ever grew to hate very quickly. You know, with that being said, I think that it's something where there needs to be an introductory step, a first thing where, you know, people that are interested can get involved. And I liked your reply a lot, because I'm always thinking of this. This is an issue that I've thought of for about a year and a half or 2 years, where, you know, the perspective of this is for drug dealers has really changed to, it changed at one point to this is for forward-thinking technologists, to this is for, you know, fringe libertarians, this is for this. There's so many definitions of why someone is into Bitcoin, and it really has a fragmented message, and it is impossible to market as that one goal. I do appreciate your answer, though, and I think it's great, and that's really for every company involved in the scene to really know their market and market it to them perfectly, and you'll have an overall greater idea of what it does.
So Eric...
Yeah, it's the...
Go ahead.
Eric, continue.
I was just going to say that it is it's the same sort of tension between a centralized project and a decentralized project. You know, most companies and businesses, they are centralized entities with one specific goal. And there are lots of efficiencies that come from being centralized. But there's also some problems with it. And you lose a certain creativity when you have to pigeonhole something into one specific message. So while the fact that the Bitcoin industry is large and diverse and fragmented, that causes some problems in terms of marketing. Like there isn't really a cohesive face of Bitcoin, and that there is a negative aspect. But at the same time, it allows a certain diversity and all sorts of different projects to move in different ways, you know, most of which will fail. But that process of experimentation, just like what happened with the internet, is what will turn Bitcoin into a platform used all over the world.
Speaking of projects being a part of this sort of multifaceted decentralized movement, can you tell us a little bit about your work in the space, about Coinapult?
Yeah. So I've been involved in a number of projects. Coinapult was my most recent. I stepped down as CEO back in February. But Coinapult is a company down in Panama. And basically it's an e-wallet and a merchant processing service. But its primary product is something called Lox, which is, I think, a super important tool for people in the Bitcoin world to understand. Basically, one of the main problems that people rightly criticize Bitcoin for is its volatility. And while some Bitcoiners don't mind it, for normal people who just want to use money, the volatility is a serious problem. So Lox was a tool that allows someone to use cryptocurrency and avoid the volatility. And unfortunately, all of Coinapult services aren't available whatsoever in the U.S. So I imagine a lot of your listeners may not be able to utilize it, but hopefully you have some international as well.
So we definitely do.
Talk to us a little bit about, you know, the regulatory landscape has really changed since the early days of Bitcoin and, you know, digital money in general. Well, I'll speak in terms of crypto money because we had, you know, Hashcash and e-gold and a number of things prior. But things have really, you know, sort of changed over time. And you talk about, you know, Coinapult not being available in the United States. Give us your perspective of the lay of the land and what the state is doing in terms of these new innovations.
So there has been certainly positive developments. So like when I got involved in Bitcoin in 2011, a lot of us sat around speculating, you know, how mean and nasty the U.S. government would be. Because certainly, if it takes off, it is an existential threat to both the banking system and the federal government's ability to spend money by printing it. So we were wondering kind of how bad it would be. The good news is that it seems that the U.S. government, you know, mostly represented by the New York entities right now, they have been, you know, sort of normally hostile and aggressive and wanting to control everything, but they have not wanted to take the path of outright banning it. And it does not seem that they are trying to vilify Bitcoin. So that's good. But of course, you know, good for the government is a relative term. And what they are doing is trying to force Bitcoin to comply with the various rules that were built up for the current financial system and for banks. There is a severe tension there because Bitcoin affords privacy by default. Not perfect anonymity all the time, but a great deal of privacy. And banking regulations often are the opposite of that. They try to always know who each party is to a transaction. And there's a good reason why that sort of had to exist in the past, because the payment systems and banks that people have used, those systems are so insecure and terribly designed for modern commerce that if you don't know who all the parties are, you can be defrauded and you have no recourse. But Bitcoin is so secure, and when you pay someone, you know that the money is good immediately. A lot of the justification for knowing who the parties are isn't there anymore. And in my opinion, people absolutely have the right to privacy if they're not even being accused of a crime. And so they should expect that privacy, not only when it comes to their home, but when it comes to, you know, and what books they read and what religion they practice, but how they use their money and how much money they earn and all that as well. So basically that tension is problematic and is not going to go away. And we recognized that very early on. And that was why we decided to set up Coinapult in Panama and not serve American customers at all, because the rules are set up in such a way that even serving one U.S. customer can require you to basically get private personal information from all your customers. Because if you don't do that, then how do you know which ones are Americans? So that's super invasive. I mean, I have a moral issue with requiring private information from some farmer in Mexico and giving it to the United States government. I think it's morally wrong, And so we decided to fight it with through our actions and how we set up the company.
You know, so that's something that's really fascinating to me. And you drew a very important delineation there, is when you're not being accused of a crime, right, you should have a complete and total right to privacy, right? There's no argument about, you know, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, right? Like, it's not about that. It's actually about you have a fundamental right to that privacy, right? Unless you violated someone else's freedoms, right? And subsequently created whether that be a common law crime or an actual legislative crime. And I found that really, really interesting that we have the opportunity to sort of vote with our entrepreneurial feet and go to these places now, because now we have a monetary system that grants us that freedom. We no longer have to be bound to the U.S. banking system because, you know, the U.S. dollar and, you know, you must be a U.S. citizen to do all of these things. Now we have the freedom to do that.
Yeah, and as a follow-up to that, whenever I'm explaining Bitcoin to someone, there was someone that I knew and I haven't spoken with in a couple of years, and they asked me, and I went on to the long, the usual explanation, and it really ended up with one thing: you control your money. No one's able to seize your funds. No one's ever able to charge you fees on it and take it out of your account without authorization. Long before, you know, the explanations of, you know, private and public keys and how that works and just all the cryptography and, you know, all that. That to me is the key of the technology, is that you control your money. You control the private keys, you control where it goes, and it's beautiful. And I just wanted to interject with that, because as I'm explaining it to new faces and new people that are genuinely interested in, that's like a sticking point that I've noticed happen multiple times, where another light bulb may go off.
The issue of privacy, I think, is really crucial, and it is going to be sort of the moral philosophical argument that Bitcoin forces into the public discourse. I think people in general assume that privacy is legitimate. It's the reason that you're allowed to have locks on your doors and curtains on your windows, and it is not only not permitted, but most people would find the idea abhorrent if the government had a camera in your house watching you. Most people would think that was terrible, because people have a natural, you know, free individuals should have a natural right to privacy in their home. So why does that argument not extend to the realm of money? It certainly should. And hopefully people will be able to make that leap to realize that there's not much different between permitting someone to have privacy in their home, where can do bad things, and permitting privacy with their money, where also too they can do bad things.
So, what do you think is needed, I guess, based on sort of that estimation of the value of Bitcoin, to carry not only the adoption of the technology forward, but sort of the understanding of those values of privacy and individual freedom? What do you think is needed in crypto finance and in technology in general
to increase adoption?
Not only to increase adoption, I would say, but to sort of make the use of technology really compatible with that understanding of privacy and freedom that you talked about, that is such a big part of Bitcoin.
To sort of lubricate the resurgence of liberty.
You could put it that way.
Yeah. The technology already does it. The Bitcoin technology and most Bitcoin services already permit amazing degrees of privacy. So the technology is there. The issue is a cultural and political one. And currently, if you talked to almost any politician or regulator, the idea of financial privacy, while they may pretend to like it on a superficial level, they will be repulsed by it very quickly when you actually start getting into specifics. And so those are the minds that have to change. I don't expect changing those minds will be quick or easy, especially because many of their jobs depend on the claim that they have the right to essentially spy on people. A lot of them are financial spies.
Yeah, one of the things that,
saying that explicitly, but that's what they do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, we have to, you know, as a people, you know, sort of remember, is that the government, you know, works for us, right? So there's a lot of questions of transparency.
Supposed to work for us.
Well, right.
Sorry.
Is it, you know, regardless of, you know, which government you're a member of, they're supposed to be looking out for the well-being of their people. What are the things that, you know, is this a generational gap issue where, you know, maybe it does take, you know, 30 or 50 years for society, philosophy, you know, governments to really start to change from the inside out, because the people who have slowly grown up in this this new era where now suddenly, you know, true financial transparency and liberties and freedoms are now available in ways that genuinely were not available previously, but are rights, right? Is this something where we have to just keep working at it, keep being diligent and keep focusing, and just, you know, weather the storm, and it's going to take, you know, decades? Or is this something that's going to happen relatively quickly? What are your thoughts, Eric?
I don't think it will take decades, because Bitcoin isn't a theory that, you know, like artificial intelligence, which we know someday will be upon us, but which right now we don't really need to worry about. Bitcoin is here and operating and is a huge growing industry right now. So it's going to force the discussion to happen much sooner than it otherwise would. And the thing that keeps me the most optimistic, because I think not only are the politicians and regulators against financial, but a lot of people are too. And they have the feeling that if you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to hide? And of course, they don't hold that same position when it comes to the curtains on their house, but people have a lot of conflicts in their thinking anyway. But because Bitcoin is here now, the economic efficiencies that it brings, that this instant digital money and all the crazy things that can be done with digital finance, just the economic efficiencies of that will be the incentive for civilization to at least consider the arguments that privacy should be permitted. Because when it is, you get more wealth. You get a system which moves more easily, and more wealth for people is often a convincing argument. So hopefully that will be the thing that let people kind of get out of.
Absolutely. I you know, before we wrap this up, I wanted to ask you a quick question. I'd love to ask, what companies or projects are you really finding interesting and fascinating coming up in this next year? And who, I guess the way I like to phrase it is, who do you hope gets lots of funding quick?
So this year, I think 2015 is going to be the year of Bitcoin remittances. And remittances as a feature has been something that people have talked about with Bitcoin forever, but it was more theoretical, and everyone sort of thought, yeah, it will work. We just need to wait for people to build the companies and do it. And now we have those. There are three that I know of that I guess started in 2014 and I think are going to have huge success this year, because the numbers work out to make transfer of money from end to end a fraction of what otherwise it would be. So let me think if I can think what these companies are. One is Rebit.ph, which is focused on the Philippines. One is, I think, SendBitcoin.mx, which is for the U.S.-Mexican remittance market. And then the other one is BitPesa, which is for Kenya. And these companies are not just in the idea stage, they're actually launched. Their product's working. People who don't care about Bitcoin at all can use services right now to send money to their families significantly cheaper than what they could before. So these companies have received some funding. I hope they get more if they need it, but it's going to be the year where the concept of remittances goes from the idea to the actual execution. And that's what I'm really excited about this year.
What is needed most for the growth and adoption of this? What is the biggest gap that is not being filled? You know, of course, aside from remittances,
it's just a matter of use cases. I mean, no one cares to have a Coinbase account unless they are going to speculate on the price of Bitcoin. Coinbase is not a use case; it is a tool, a utility for when the use cases happen, and the remittances are an actual use case. So Bitcoin will grow to the extent that it finds more use cases, and I think there are quite a few. I mean, online gambling was one of the early ones. Obviously, Silk Road and the dark net markets were another one early on. And as people figure out these ways that Bitcoin can save money and make things more efficient and faster and better, Those specific use cases will drive adoption.
I totally agree. All right, final thing. Is there anything you've got you want to share, any links, anything you want to plug, anything that you feel that you maybe you're working on or you want a little more attention to? We'll share that with our audience.
What I'm working on right now is still a secret, so I can't reveal it. But I think it will be revealed in the not-too-distant future. But, yeah, I don't think I have anything to plug necessarily other than those remittance companies. I think everyone should check those out. And if you have family and friends that send money back to people, you should tell them about it because those things will spread by word of mouth. And so stoking that fire is a really good idea. Other than that, my only advice is to not worry about this ridiculous price crash that's happened over the last few months. I've been through a number of these bubbles and they, you know, they're euphoric on the way up and they're depressing on the way down. And ultimately you got to just realize that Bitcoin is a win or lose proposition. It's going to take over the world of finance or it is going to fail and go to zero. And as long as you're okay with those outcomes, you know, anything in between is just the market figuring it out. So, you know, focus on the long term and try not to worry.
Amen, brother. It's giving people back the freedom and the power, which is all it's about, really. And we want to encourage every listener to follow you on Twitter. Your Twitter handle is Eric Voorhees.
Yeah, it's at Eric, E-R-I-K, Voorhees, V, like Victor, O-O-R-H-E-E-S.
Perfect. And we want to thank you so much for doing Decentralize, and we hope to speak to you in the future.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Justified, but they're in the bag. Can't get truth and right. You're justified.